description.
It's an analogy. It can only be carried so far.
Exactly, Ed. So what I'm asking the audience, smart people that they all are, is to what degree is this analogy faulty?
VDH with a comment.
Yes, VDH.
Yeah, I think the actual energy is carried by the field, by the electric and magnetic fields. Go ahead.
Give that man a gold star. I think, unfortunately, a lot of us kind of walk away with the simple approach because we've talked about it before in the technical net. Dick used to mention regularly that the idea of electrons zooming through a conductor is a faulty concept. Actual speed that electrons drift in a DC wire are something like inches per hour. They drift very, very slowly. And sometimes people try to help that analogy out by then conjuring up a hollow tube with a lot of ball bearings, filling up marbles, filling up the pipe. And you push one ball bearing into the pipe on one end, and another ball bearing pops out the other end. And that kind of gives people a better sense that they know what's going on, that electrons traveling through the conductor are producing the energy. Of course, that has a problem when you shift from DC to AC, where nothing really goes anyplace. The net distance of an electron is zero because it jiggles back, forth, and back and forth. So the problem is that this analogy sort of collapses in on itself. And the answer is that it's not actually the flow of electrons in a conductor that produce the energy transfer. It is the electromagnetic waves induced by that phenomena, which then produce something called pointing vectors, which we've talked a lot about for electromagnetic waves, and that it is the actual area around wires that contain the energy that's being transferred, not the wire itself, which can confuse a lot of people. Let me drop for a sec.
I suggest you spell pointing because they may be misunderstanding you.
Okay, very well, Ed. It is named after a gentleman whose last name was Poynting. He spelt it P-O-Y-N-T-I-N-G. So it's kind of a humorous misuse of a guy's last name. So it's not pointing such as P-O-I-N-T-I-G. It's pointing as P-O-Y-N-T-I-N-G, the man's name. So the pointing vector is at a right angle to both the excitation of the electric field and the magnetic field, which for electromagnetic waves, you've seen the drawings where the electric potential goes up and down and the magnetic potential goes at right angles up and down in phase, and the propagation direction where the light goes to, it's from its origin to its destination, is called the pointing vector.
I wasn't really present when you were formulating your content. Are you alluding to also to sending energy through the copper wire?
Well, the point is that although we regularly say we're sending electrical energy through the copper wire, we are not doing that. We are actually sending energy through a series of electromagnetic waves surrounding the conducting wire, which is can be confusing, but it sort of can explain a curious thing that some people take for granted. There's something called velocity factor of coaxial cables. Velocity factor is the fraction of the speed of light that the transmission wire, the signal goes through the transmission wire. It begs the question, well, if the energy is all going through the center conductor the copper. Why is it slowing down? And especially, why do some coaxial cables have one velocity factor and others have other velocity factors? And the answer to that is because what's really going on is in the dielectric. The dielectric is principally the determining factor for the velocity factor of coaxial cables. Again, because unfortunately, most people don't really think of it that way, but the energy transfer is going on within the dielectric and surrounding the conductors, not in the conductors.
May I play Devil Advocate and challenge you in it?
Feel free.
Was that to me? I think I doubled.
Yeah, I just heard Wesley. Wesley wanted to play devil's advocate. I always play his devil's advocate, so he's more than, it's fine. Please feel free to be devil's advocate, and we'll get to you, Ed, right after Wesley.
Let's start from the beginning. We have a copper wire and has no insulation on it, and we have the electron flows. And it's AC current that is going in it. The electrons in outer shells of the atom are pushed out, and they become free electrons. They join to another atom, and we have ionic interaction. The other ions, atoms don't feel comfortable with it, release their own electrons, and actually the information is first. Once you put the source of energy into the wire, the information is immediately felt 1,000 miles from that point. So that's how the energy is transferred. It's actually one electron giving information to another one, and another one, and then one, but a speed of moving the electron is very slow. Now, when we come to the coaxial cable. In coaxial cable, we're dealing with dielectric, but we're dealing also with other shell of that wire, and that represents a certain impedance to the signal. So let's say we have a proper load on it, and now we have a little bit different situation. We don't deal any longer with only the electron flow, but we're dealing with the impedance match of that transmission line that must match the load. And if not, then we have high SWR. And yes, I do agree with you that now we're dealing with the response of the impedance between the inner wire and outer shell of it. And we have the dielectric in between of it. But I'm not that sure that the electric field around the wire carries on the energy. It carries on the information, but not the energy. And to Xia.
AC2GS. Well, I disagree with both things that you said, Wesley. You can have effectively an alternating current that is so fast that no electron moves to another atom. It just jiggles in place. So you don't have the transfer of free electrons, even though it's capable in a conductor. It's not required for alternating current. It just is a matter of how many cycles per second and what the drift velocity for electrons are, which we mentioned are relatively slow. So that's one thing. So you can have just jiggling electrons in their orbit, not even jumping out of their orbit. Number two, impedance has nothing, as far as I'm aware, to do with velocity factor. Velocity factor is purely proportional to the dielectric constant of the coaxial cable. So you can have a 50 ohm impedance coax cable that has a velocity factor of 0.90 or 0.66. They have the same exact impedance. They have different velocity factors because the dielectric material is different and the flow of the electromagnetic waves through the dielectric material is different and gives a different effective velocity for the signal.
Roy, can I add something?
Certainly, Andy.
As I understand it, isn't velocity factor a direct function of the amount of capacitance or the amount of charge, because the capacitor has a charge on it, or a capacitor charges up? So that dielectric will determine the amount of capacitance in the coax cable itself, which will determine the amount of charge the time it would take to charge the dielectric or to charge the capacitance of the coax cable, if I'm saying that right. I thought that would be a more direct result of velocity factor, the amount of capacitance of the coax cable. Is that correct?
Well, we're looking at it sort of the same thing from different angles. You can say that by changing the dielectric, you're changing the capacitance of the coaxial cable, although you have to adjust the inductance so that the end impedance is the same 50 ohms. But the effect of changing the dielectric constant does have an effect on the capacitance. But I think more fundamentally, as far as electrodynamic theory is involved, it has much more to play with the simple concept of a higher dielectric constant. Effectively, it's like an optical density. It slows down the apparent speed of light. So in RF, the dielectric in that environment slows down the transmission of electromagnetic waves that are going through it. So you might correlate it with capacitance, but I think the fundamental mechanism for the velocity factor change is not a capacitance, but simply that the dielectric itself slows down the progression of electromagnetic waves in that core where the dielectric is.
WA2VDH with a comment.
Yes, VDH.
Yeah, well, actually, the way to remember it, at least I find it, is that V propagation, the velocity of propagation, is 1 over the square root of the permittivity times the permeability. So for coaxial cable, the permeability is pretty much the same as free space, mu zero. So it really depends on the permittivity. So it works out to be C over the square root of the dielectric constant, C over the square root of E sub R, and that gives you the actual velocity of propagation.
Yeah, it's directly related to the square root of the dielectric constant. It's just that Andy and I are kind of have a semi-semantic discussion of whether the dielectric constant is changing a capacitance factor as opposed to just acting as a natural as a form of dielectric that's simply slowing the conduction of electromagnetic waves through it.
Wait, let me clarify one thing. Yeah, I'm not looking at it as a change, because the VDH, you could, and hello to you too, you could clarify this. The capacitance of a piece of coax cable is constant. It doesn't change. It's a manufacturer's specification, and they usually rate it as capacitance per foot, as far as I recall. Is that right? Capacitance per foot, and it depends on how the cable is manufactured, the material that they use, obviously, that would determine the amount of capacitance that the piece of coax cable has, and that's a constant. It doesn't change. Am I correct?
You know, capacitance depends upon the same dielectric constant. Maybe they're linked.
Exactly.
Well, that's what I'm trying to get at. It's the chicken and the egg sort of thing. One affects the other. The way that I understand the electrodynamics is it's the fundamental aspect of a dielectric material slowing down the transmission of electromagnetic waves going through it. One of the effects that that has effectively changes the capacitance of a given material.
You say tomato, I say tomato. It's the same thing, brought to a higher level.
Interesting.
For RF.
Yeah, I agree, but the point that I'm trying to get at is, if you think of it purely as terms of changing the constant capacitance of a coaxial cable, I think you tend to lose sight with the underlying weirdness that the electromagnetic waves surrounding the conductor are the means for transportation of the signal, not actually just the electrons flowing back and forth in the central conductor. And it lends itself to an illustration on my link page. If anyone has my link page up there, it has a nice little diagram of a very simple DC circuit where there's a light bulb, a battery, and a switch, and the wire has been stretched out to be an entire light second long in length. And the question is, when you pull the switch, how long does it take before the light bulb gets some of the current from that battery that you just turned the switch?
It's W-A-2-C-D-L. That was my visualization. What you just said, Roy, is the instant you turn that switch on. If you are looking into the wire at the very end of the wire, no matter how long it is, how long does it take for a change to occur, for electrons to move, or what? I'm just using that as a general term. If you're looking at it, how long will it take for that to occur in time? And it's not a, like you say, I'm just thinking it's a slow. It's a slow time. It's not instantaneous.
KC2FFX.
Yes. What would you like to say? I think it was SFF.
It was dielectric. I don't know.
Yes. Is that you, Charlie?
Indeed.
Okay, Charlie, what would you like to say tonight?
Okay, perhaps my question wasn't heard. Isn't coaxial cable dielectric?
Okay, Charlie, you're dropping in and out of the repeater. I'm not quite sure if the signal is the problem, or you're over deviating, or there's a partial disconnect with your microphone. But I only heard about a quarter of that.
KC2FFA. Copy?
Yes, Charlie, I copy you. What's your comment?
My comment is, isn't every single coaxial cable dielectric, or whatever that word is, you know?
I didn't get the last word. You said, isn't every coaxial cable, and then I couldn't make that out.
I don't know what the word is. I'm not really electronically, educated. Dielectric. The word the guys were using. Is it coaxial cable? Dielectric or something like that.
Yeah, every coaxial cable is kind of by definition coaxial. It has a center lead, it has an outer braid. It then has something in between which is non-conducting or a dielectric. Sometimes it's filled with air. Sometimes it's filled with a different type of plastic. It could be Teflon, it could be polyethylene, it could be polypropylene. There's a bunch of different, and they all have different dielectric constants that add a characteristic to that coaxial cable. You know, most of the coaxial cables we use have a 50 ohm impedance, but they may use different dielectric materials to get there.
Let me see if I got it. I think someone was coming on. Yes, dielectric. That's the word I was looking for. Okay. Carry on, my friend. Thanks for letting me jump in. KC2FFA.
You're welcome, Charlie. Wesley recognized. I'm trying to kind of tie this up in a bow because I don't want to take too much time from Paul. Now, I just want to again point out that on my link page is a relatively simple picture. It basically shows a diagram of the Earth, of a piece of wire that's looped around. The circuit itself is one light second wide. That's a very long piece of wire. Let's just assume that it has a negligible resistance. And the big question is, you connect the switch, you close the switch, you got a battery on your side, you got a light bulb on the other side, and the choice of the time interval that from closing the switch to current showing up on the light bulb is either A, half of a second, B, 1 second, C, 2 seconds, D, 1/C, or E, none of the above. So if anyone wants to play the game with me, what I just mentioned before is a very useful thing, so use that and come up with an answer.
KD2FIU.
Yes, George.
Depends on the frequency and the conductor.
We're not going into very, very specific things because obviously a wire that long would have a ridiculously high resistance. So we're just kind of doing a generalization. And so you got a choice. You got a choice of five different things. You got 0.5 seconds, 1 second, 2 seconds, 1/C, or E, none of the above. So if you had to pick one of those five, that's the choice tonight.
And I look at the energy, I look at the frequency of the energy, it's not like you're pushing it through, like you've got a blank conductor there waiting for something to come through. It depends on the frequency and the type of conductor that it is that you're going to excite the energy through. So I don't understand how it comes into five different little answers.
Do it with DC. I have a waveguide here. I can't find the center conductor at all, no matter how hard I look.
Sorry, Ed. This particular experiment does not have a coaxial cable. It's just a simple wire. Well, it's a magic simple wire that you can extend for a whole light second and not have to worry about its inherent resistance.
Wire. It depends upon the composition. It depends upon the diameter of the wire. It depends upon the current that you're putting through it. It's not. See, the electrons are not sitting, waiting there to be pushed.
Okay. Back to you, Ed. I wasn't quite sure what you mean by the center. There is no center feed. It's not a coaxial cable in this illustration.
Always.
Are there a pair of wires?
It is a relatively simple loop. It is a single wire in a loop with a battery and then a switch, and then it goes off right and left and then makes a sharp right turn about 1 meter in distance and then turns back towards the center position. In the middle of it is a lamp. The loop is 1 meter by 1 light second in length.
Well, I would tend to think 1 over C, but if there's some dielectric constant associated with the two wires, then that would make it none of the above. So I'm either going to say 1 over C or none of the above.
Okay, for the sake of the illustration, because of the length of the wire, most of it takes place in outer space. So for all intents and purposes, you're talking about a dielectric that's a vacuum.
1 over C.
You are quite correct. It is almost instantaneous. It is 1 over C. And again, the reason why, if you think in terms of the energy being conveyed through the wire, you would sort of have to make a case that it's going from one end of the wire to the other end. If it's 1 light second long, it's going to take something like 1 light second to get there. But that's not what's going on. What's going on is you're having electromagnetic waves propagate across the 1 meter distance between the two halves of the loop, and that's where it's 1C over S. So the answer is 1C over S, and the takeaway is that the energy transfer is not going on in the conductor. It is going on around the conductor. And they figured that out, I think, back in 1916 or something. They put down a transcontinental telegraph system that was completely worthless because it was insulated with something like iron cables. And the iron cables disrupted the electromagnetic field surrounding the conductor inside the cable, and so they couldn't use it. So they had to redesign everything. But it came to them as a surprise back then that the by insulating the conductor and blocking the electromagnetic waves that are needed to propagate the signal, you screw up the signal. Yes, Wesley. You keep it short because, I don't want to take up too much of Paul's time.
Okay, let's see if we agree or disagree. The reason I played Devil's Advocate is because of the engineering purposes. We often analyze coaxial cable behavior in terms of current and voltage on the conductors using telegraphic equations. But if we want to explain how the energy flow in coaxial cable, is it electrical, electromagnetic, or both, then let's see if you agree. The energy flow in coaxial cable is a form of electromagnetic wave that propagates in space between inner and outer conductor. And the electrostatics, the laws of the electrostatics and electromagnetics dictate us both the electric and magnetic components of this wave are both transverse to the direction of propagation. So we have a transverse electromagnetic TEM wave. Then the inner and outer conductors serve the confined the fields within the cable by establishing boundary conditions. There is no external magnetic field around the coaxial cable because at any given instant the fields from the currents on the inner and outer conductors cancel itself. But when the coaxial cable is transmitting DC, the energy flow can be regarded as a special case of propagating TEM wave with the frequency of zero, which has reached its stationary condition after turn on, with the constant current flowing in opposing direction in the outer and inner conductor at given instant. And of course, the pointing vector model of the energy flow also holds at zero frequency of or DC. Do you agree now?
Well, with what you just said, yes, but it basically is the same thing that I said earlier, that most people generally tend to think that the energy is being conducted by the conductor. It's not. It's being conducted in the region of the dielectric itself, and that the pointing vector is the direction that the energy transfer is going. So you just kind of restated what I said earlier in terms of the coaxial cable. So in that light, I would agree with everything that you just mentioned. This works for both alternating current and direct current. It is all an electromagnetic phenomena, which is described in Maxwell's equations.
Indeed, but what I wanted to point is why I was trying to challenge you. We usually analyze coaxial cable in terms of current and voltage at the conductors, and that's telegraphic equations. But I didn't say the next thing. The model is only an approximation of the reality, because a coaxial cable used at frequencies where its transmission line behavior is significant. It is not lumped circuit, and there isn't, strictly saying, a well-defined electrostatic potential function that describes it exactly. And to XGS.
AC2GS. Well, again, I agree with you that that's the whole reason why they put down the transatlantic cable incorrectly and had to figure it out after the fact. One of the people who pointed out the idea that they weren't taking into account the electromagnetic wave propagations was Heaviside, who kind of tweaked and adjusted Maxwell's theory in a form that we see them today. What we call Maxwell equations are not exactly identical to Maxwell's original equations. Heaviside kind of simplified them a little bit and made them a little prettier. But, yeah, I agree. All these things are models. Models are limited analogies, and I'm trying to bring people closer to the reality of the situation and a little farther away from the analogy that the flow of electrons is what's going on in electric circuits, which they aren't. They're going on at the level of the pointing vector of electromagnetic waves surrounding the conductors.
We're actually talking about the same thing. I was talking about telegraph equation, and you mentioned Oliver Heaviside. So telegraph equations are a pair of linear partial differential equations that describe the voltage and the current on the electrical transmission line with distance and time. And as far as Oliver Heaviside, he was the one who developed the transmission line model. What was that? 1800-something, 1870-something, whatever. But I remember the name of the paper that was extra current. That was the name of the paper. And to exchange.
Yeah, I think his work was a little bit later than 1870s, but I could be wrong. I have to check on the dates. But, I'm just trying to kind of give people the sense of what is going on that have been kind of simplified away for some people. Some guys who've gone through electrical engineering courses, no pointings vector, knows all about this, but most of us out there didn't take that much physics and don't know. So I just thought it would be nice. In addition to the illustrations, I will include some nice reference material. There have been YouTubes on this subject going back to about a year or two ago, although, again, people knew about it decades. People knew about it back when they put the telegraph cable transatlantically. So I thank you, Wesley. I thank everyone that participated. I hope you guys don't have too much of a headache. I hope you learned a little something that you could add to your repertoire. And any closing comments before we turn it over to Paul, which I've taken much too much time from?
Just a brief one, KB2DXC.
Yes.
Okay, not on any subjects that you spoke about this evening, but in previous evenings you mentioned that you were involved with a 10-meter net on Sundays, and I'd like to know the time and the frequency that you guys do that. KB2DXC.
Yes, indeed. We run every Sunday morning at 28.380 upper sideband.
And what time does that get underway generally?
11 a.m. usually.
Okay, so I got 28.380 at 11 a.m. on Sundays. I'm assuming that you're net control or that kind of shifts around.
It shifts around a bit. Some people take the job from me, but for the next few weeks, if you get on the air, more likely you'll hear from me. I'd love to hear from you on the 10-meter net. Propagation has not been very good the last few weeks. A month ago, it was beautiful. There was a contest that went on where the QRM was all over the darn place. So hopefully those conditions will return.
Okay, thank you very much. It won't take up any more of your net time. KB2DXC is clear.
Very good. Well, again, thanks everyone who participated tonight. I did appreciate it. I hope you people enjoyed it. Now let's bring on Paul, WS2N, with the SpaceNet Report. And I apologize, Paul, for taking so much time out of your segment. But, of course, you can go for as long as you want.
AC2G, SWS2N, no problem, Roy. This is a TechNet anyway. The space portion is originally came about to, more or less to fill in time, you know, speaking about what was going on in space with astronauts that had call letters, and we used to talk a lot about the Oscar satellites and all. So, you know, it's a TechNet. And anyway, I'm sitting here getting absorbed into, you know, in the conversation anyway. So very interesting. Also on your webpage, by the way, tonight Roy put up a story about a nuclear power plant that they plan on building in Wyoming. Apparently Bill Gates is behind some of the money of it. But apparently they plan on building this thing with a type of used fission fuel that they'll be able to utilize if they get this thing built in Wyoming. It would produce, I think, around 400 megawatts of power. You know, they're looking for half a gigawatt, which is pretty close to what Shoreham Nuclear Power Plant started out with the idea of doing that years ago. Of course, they built it, and unfortunately, they never powered it up and put out electricity. They powered it up, but they never sent any power down down the lines up on Shoreham. But of course, this is a different deal. They don't have to worry about the evacuation problem that Shoreham had, and all the other problems that we had on the island. So hopefully that one gets built. There hasn't been a brand new commissioned power plant since there was one in Tennessee, but besides that, 25, 26 years ago. So, you know, they pretty much come to a grinding halt. I think there's like 109 active nuclear power plants in this country, and the rest are all coal and oil, and of course now we're going into wind and solar. We'll see what happens down the road. Who's going to make all this power for these electric cars that are going to be built? they probably have to double the amount of power plants to produce that, the electricity that would be needed if everybody was driving around in an electric car. Anyway, I just want to mention an ISS sighting that's coming up. I saw a great one last night on, you know, sort of space station go up right overhead. It was around 80-some-odd degrees, so directly right overhead. Came out of the west, went out to the east, and that was around almost 6 o'clock at night. There was another good one tonight, but and both of these were minus 4 plus magnitude. You know, if you have a minus, you know, the magnitude numbers, the lower the number, so if you have a minus 4, that's brighter than a minus 3. This was these were minus 4 magnitudes, which is very bright. And there was one tonight, but cloudy out, so I couldn't see that. But there is one Tuesday night, which should be very good, and I think it's going to be a clear night, and 3.3, minus 3.3 magnitude. And that will also come out of the west and head northeast, around 50 degrees high. So that'll be a good sighting if you think about it and you want to walk outside even for a couple of minutes. You know, for the exact time, it takes roughly 6 minutes to go from one, you know, from one location to another. And this will be a 5:10 p.m. on Tuesday night here in the on the East Coast on Long Island. So, couple of launches coming up. There's one coming up this Wednesday. It's going to go out of Vandenberg Air Force Base in California. It's called the DART mission. We've talked about that on the net many times. It's, you know, DART stands for Double Asteroid Redirection Test. And that's the one that's going to go out to a binary asteroid and see if it could deflect one of them. You know, one smaller one going around the other one like a moon, and it's going to crash into the smaller one and see if it could slow it down even for a millisecond. See if that works. That means, you know, the whole both of them will eventually start to drift into a different, slightly different orbit. I mean, almost not detectable, but enough where, you know, if you did it, and let's say this thing was going to hit Earth, you would be able to have it miss Earth. And so this is a test to see if you could do that. If it ever comes up in the future, we don't want to wind up like the dinosaurs. So this is a system that they plan on doing hopefully the far distant future. But this one's a test, and within, I guess, a year or so, they'll be able to find out if it works. The Double Asteroid Redirection Test, DART. I'll try to, I think it's going up at a weird time. In the middle of the night, 1:20 a.m. on Wednesday. So I won't be watching that. I'll watch it launch on a YouTube on one of the space sites that I always look at. Probably spacenews.com. Let me drop it. See if anybody has any questions for this portion of the net. This is WS2N. Again, the name is Paul. Okay, another launch coming up that I'll be looking forward to, or another module, a little smaller than the last module that went up to join the International Space Station. But this is going to be launched by the Russians, and it's called the Prail module, Prail, and it's actually spelled P-R-I-C-H-A-L. Russians call it the Prail module. It's a big, spherish looking type of module. It has six sides on it. And one of the sides has a match for the newest module that the Russians just sent up there a couple of months ago, called the Nyoker module, which is already docked to the space station. That was the one that had all kinds of problems with thrusters going on and flipping the whole space station upside down and all. This Prail module will dock to that, and this way they'll have, you know, four extra docking ports that they can dock future modules to. If the Russians plan on eventually separating all their modules from the International Space Station, as you know, maybe by 2030, they would eventually create their own space station, and they would need this node. That's really what it is. It's a node, a connection point for many different modules. Anyway, that would be launched on a Soyuz vehicle. I believe that's coming up. I forgot I wrote it down here somewhere. Anyway, that launch is coming up very soon, I think. This month. Anyway, I'll look for it. Another mission that will be launched in a week or two is the Soyuz mission, this crew mission to the International Space Station. And this will be a tourist mission. So you'll have one cosmonaut, Alexander Mishurkin. He'll be the commander. But you have two guys from Japan. This guy, Masawi, he's a billionaire. He's the guy who made a deal with Elon Musk. He wants to go on a spacecraft around the moon. He wants to take eight of his friends, or, you know, eight people involved in science and yachts with him. He signed up to do that a couple of years ago. Of course, that mission is nowhere near ready. So he also signed up with Russia to launch himself and a friend of his, it's really his assistant. This guy's got some kind of clothing massive company. Anyway, he's a billionaire in Japan. They say he's like the 30th richest person in Japan, and he's paying to go up, and I guess he's paying for his friend. Anyway, the Russians usually charge around $80 million a seat, so I guess he's going to pour that kind of money into Russia, the Russia space program, to launch himself to the International Space Station. The three of them will dock and spend around 10 days or so attached to the space station. But it looks like commercial flights for Russians are now in full blast. Just last month, they launched a film crew to the space station, one Russian cosmonaut. They had an actress and a film director go up on a Soyuz spacecraft, and again, they spent 10 to 12 days up there filming, and then eventually they deorbited and came back to Earth. So, I mean, it's been a long spell. I think roughly around 12 years or so since the Russians have had private citizens going up to the space station. Last guy was the guy that owned Cirque du Soleil. He went up, and that was in 2009. But now between the Russians and now the U.S., we're doing the same thing. We have a planned mission going up in February to the International Space Station that are bringing people that are paying a company called Axiom to do basically the same thing. And then there'll be four people on that mission. So, I mean, this year alone, there's been, I don't know, over 30 people that have launched themselves into space on different platforms. And that number is only going to increase probably next year. And we'll get to the point where we won't be able to keep track. before this year started, there were roughly 560 people that have gone into space, and now we're just over 600. And I can see that number accelerating as the years go by. We'll see how it goes. If the economies in the world stay the way they are, with all these billionaires pouring money into the spacecraft and into the rockets, and the countries themselves too are all expanding as well. The U.S., European Space Agency, Spain, individually, they're developing a rocket that they plan on sending up in a couple, you know, maybe about 4 or 5 years. They plan on launching out of a new launch complex in Norway. This complex is opening up all over. Another one in Scotland, you know. So we'll see. We'll try to keep track of them all. This is WS2N. Okay, I should mention the probably the main topic that's been talked about on most news stations is last week. Russia blew up a satellite on purpose. They launched from Plyusk, Russia. Russia has a couple of launch locations. They have one in Plyusk, which is northern Russia. They have one in Baikonur in Kazakhstan that they use for their manned missions. And then they have another one in western Russia. Now, this one is in Plyusk, and the guy in charge of Russia, Roscosmos, that Dmitry Rodigin is in charge of it, and he launched, I guess it's really a missile, and hit one of their own satellites. It's a Russian anti-satellite test. Sure enough, as it went overhead, over Plyusk, Russia, and they launched a rocket. Sure enough, it hit an existing Russian satellite called Cosmos 1408. Thing was a couple of thousand pounds. I think it was 2,000 kilograms, over 4,000 pound satellite that they decided to destroy. It wasn't operating anymore, but they needed a target, and that's what they did. Now they have 1,500 large pieces of junk flying around the Earth every 90 minutes that we are trying to keep track of. NORAD does a great job. There's literally millions of pieces flying around the Earth, and hundreds of thousands of pieces over 10 centimeters big, roughly 4 inches, that they could track by radar. And with this crazy stunt that Russia pulled, they just added 1,500 more pieces that big, plus countless other small ones. So after they did that, naturally it was detected. Mission Control in Houston sent a message to the International Space Station to get to your lifeboats. You know, right now there's 7 people on board the space station. I waved to them when they went overhead last night, but those 7 people, 4 of them got into their American spacecraft, the Crew Dragon, and they stay there in case something bad happens to the space station. They're able to undock and come on home. And then the three people over on the Russian side, they got into their Soyuz spacecraft. And they weighed out the you all clear sign. To do that, by the way, they close all the ports, all the doors to the different ports. You know, you have a different ports open to the port side, off the starboard side, and some of them below looking down, and some of them looking up. They closed all of them, so you just had your main, like, fuselage from one end to the other. You know, from the front end, you have Dragon attached to Harmony, and Harmony is attached to Destiny, you know, the other American module. Another American module is attached to Unity, and that, from there, they have the adapter piece, the pressure rating adapter number one, which it's really an adapter to get to the Russian side. That goes to the Zarya module on Russia, and that in turn goes to the Zvezda module, and on that far end is the Russian spacecraft, the Soyuz. So that whole fuselage, that all stays open. All the other doors going to the Columbus module, going to the big Japanese module, the Kaibo module, the Tranquility module, that's all cut off. The cupola is cut off. They close all the doors to even beam the Bigelow expandable module, that inflatable one that's still attached to the space station. They close that door. They even close the door to the Quest module that's used to do spacewalks. They close that off. The multi-purpose module, which is another module that sticks out of the Tranquility module, they close that one. And, you know, they use that for storage and stuff. And they waited it out, and then they got the all clear from Houston. But this stuff is still flying around. I mean, if it comes in their path again, they will get another call to do the exact same thing all over again. So, crazy. But that's what goes on. There's also another space station up there. The Chinese have their Tiangong space station with three people on board, two guys and a lady flying around. And I'm sure they had to do the same thing. They're on a slightly different path. We're at 51.8 degrees on the inclination, and China is like 41. But still, the same altitude. We're all about 250 miles up. This was a 300-mile. Well, it started out at 300 miles, but the debris, of course, will drift up, drift down. So I would imagine something's got to be done. They need to have maybe the UN or somebody get involved with having some kind of an agreement between these countries. China did this a few years ago. Same thing, they blew up one of their satellites. So they should come to an agreement. You know, there's eventually going to be other countries. India, they have capability to launch into space. Japan, they do it as well. There's got to be some kind of a national agreement to stop blowing up satellites. Not good. Any comments, questions? WS2S. Okay. Very good. Nothing hard. Curiosity. I don't talk about that much anymore. That's the Mars rover, one of the Mars rovers that's still active. Landed in 2012, still doing good. And it did a nice radiation experiment recently. On a top deck. Now this thing is big. It's like 10 feet by 10 feet. This rover, six wheels, with a mast sticking up. It stands, higher than me, 7 feet tall. And on the top deck, you have a lot of equipment, to measure the atmosphere, the wind, there's all kinds of things to put samples into the body to test materials, whatever the arm digs up. But over on the one side, the of the vehicle on the left-hand side, the port side, on the top is a round circle. It looks like about 2.5 inches in diameter, and they call it the RAD, the Radiation Assessment Detector. So essentially,